Historically, carbon offsetting came about as a result of the Kyoto Protocol being adopted in 1997. And what the UN did was created a framework called the Clean Development Mechanism, which was a set of guidelines or rules for how you might set up carbon trading. It was not a carbon market itself. It was just a framework for one.
Hello, welcome to the Republic Podcast. Today we have a very special guest. As Earth Day is coming up, he is Paul Gamble, CEO and co-founder at Nori. Welcome, Paul.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I am Kinsa. I'm the head of growth at Republic Crypto. And today we'll be discussing how, from the expert, the co-founder of Nori, about climate tech industry and what Nori's up to in this field. I think it's a very interesting area right now, especially with the big narrative going around ESG, crypto technology is gaining traction. And also, you guys are a portfolio company of Republic as well. I think back in 2019, You guys did a raise, January 2019, I think about 145,000. And it's really cool to see you guys still running strong. Gaining traction over the years, and
we did that during the depths of crypto winter. I think when we closed the campaign December 31st of 2018, and I believe that the low for Bitcoin was somewhere like it was like $3,000 or something, and it was during that month of December. So we could not have timed it more poorly.
Yeah, I mean, I remember those times. It was some dark times. But I'm surprised you guys pushed through. Honestly, so many people just left the crypto industry, stopped believing in it. But I guess, you guys, we'd love to, maybe we can dive into that to begin with, like your journey from the beginning of Nori to now.
Yeah. So, I mean, I got into Bitcoin in 2011. So to me, that like crypto winter was like, it's not like blockchain is dying. This is just a normal market cycle. I've been through that multiple times before. Anyway, I got into Bitcoin in 2011 while I was in grad school, and I studied engineering undergrad, and then I got my master's in engineering management. I had this professor who was teaching us about how market trading worked, and he showed us Bitcoin trading as an example. And I went home and read the white paper that evening, and I was in a very like Ron Paul out of the Fed, monetary policy is everything kind of mindset at the time. And so I was like perfectly placed to see the Bitcoin white paper and think, whoa, okay, wow, this is it. This is like the solution to these really significant problems that are deeply impacting like every part of our society. I'm sold. But I was a grad student, so I had no money. And it's not like Bitcoin was like 80 cents at the time, but it's not like I could put in $20,000 or so and make that life-changing wealth or anything. So I started mining it. I moved to Seattle. I started working as a product manager for different agencies, but mostly at Deloitte Digital. I was building mobile apps for big Fortune 500 companies. And then Ethereum came out in 2014. And then as that was going, I was getting more excited because now it looked like, you could build anything on top of it. Like the notion of a generalizable Turing complete blockchain was really exciting. Like, okay, now we can build applications on top of this. Hmm. And I got pretty bored with the consulting gig I was working on because the thing about consulting is like by definition, you are working on the projects that they don't want to do, which means you're not going to get the most interesting work. It just got kind of boring. And I started a couple businesses on my own that didn't really go anywhere. And what I realized when I was doing that was I really missed working with a team of talented people. And around that time, so that would have been like early 2015, I read a magazine article about how climate scientists were becoming very depressed because no one was listening to them. And I thought, well, that sucks. that's a terrible experience for them. And surely there's like some sort of untapped business model here. And I wanted to build something. I wanted to build a big company, and I missed working with a team. And it seemed to me like, of course, more people were going to care about climate change in the future. So obviously I would be able to attract more talented people to work on this with me. And coming at it from an engineering mindset, I was thinking about it like, okay, first principles, what is the problem that's causing climate change? It's quite straightforward. There is too much carbon in the air. That's it. That's the whole problem. And if we could magically remove that tomorrow, then problem solved. There would be no climate change issue. The greenhouse gas effect would go away. And so then I started wondering, well, how do you pull carbon out of the air? Is that possible? And I started researching carbon dioxide removal. And I quickly realized I was in over my head. And I started a meetup group in Seattle to find other people who were interested in this so we could kind of learn together and help educate each other. And that was September 2015. We would meet monthly, and it was like 10 or 15 people. We'd read articles and books and white papers about different carbon removal techniques and stuff. And a lot of it seemed really like on the bleeding edge of technology. Like I remember reading a paper about pyrolyzing carbon atoms into a material that would then passively absorb CO2 from the air at room temperature. But it required an enormous amount of energy to make the material in the first place. So it wasn't really like effective from a net carbon perspective. And so what I was curious about was, can we build a business model that would incentivize more and more people to pull carbon out of the air? Like, is there a way to tie carbon removal with profitability? Because if you could do that, then you can use market forces to solve climate change. Because, of course, I believed it then. I believe it now. Governments are not going to be responsible for this. They have had ample opportunity. They have known about the problem for 30, 40 years or so and have done very, very, very little to actually impact the amount of carbon dioxide in the air. So this is going to have to be something that is more bottom up, decentralized, like grassroots driven. And we have to do it in a way that is truly scalable. So we kept doing that research. And then by the end of 2016, we were starting to realize that there were actually a lot of very affordable and scalable methods of carbon removal from the atmosphere that already existed. They just weren't happening at a big enough scale. And I'm thinking most primarily of more nature-based solutions like soil carbon capture, so regenerative agriculture practices that store carbon in soils, mm-hmm. tree planting, kelp farming, that kind of thing. And then, of course, there are also industrialized things like direct air capture, carbon negative cement, but those are more nascent technologies. So that was late 2016, started seeing that, and then also started to see the rise of tokenization in the Ethereum space. So more and more like early days projects that were launching tokens like Gnosis and Augur, they were examples of being able to create a token that could act as an incentive to create some sort of new behavior inside a network or ecosystem. And to me, that was a light bulb moment. Like, okay, what's missing from carbon removal is a financial incentive for people to do this. And here's this other technology that I've been involved in for nearly the entire time has existed. And I'm really excited and passionate about that too. So what if we merge these together? What if we can create a cryptocurrency that can incentivize more people to pull carbon out of the air? So that was the basic genesis of what ended up becoming Nori. In February of 2017, one of my co-founders and I did a small hackathon that IPFS and MetaMask sponsored, and it was all about carbon farming. The funny thing was, we thought it would be trivial or straightforward to build like a sensor that you could just put in the ground and measure soil carbon, and the hard part would be the token economics. And it turns out it's actually the exact opposite. Later that year in the summer, we pulled together a larger team. We entered the Blockchain for Social Impact hackathon that Consensus sponsored that year. We won and then decided to found the company. So it was in the fall of 2017 that we founded Nori here in Seattle. And what we are is a carbon removal marketplace. We are working with people who remove and sequester carbon from the air and then get that measured and verified and sell that to businesses. And the thing to know about this is, like, we're building off a lot of carbon offset infrastructure, but not all carbon offsets are the same. For the vast majority of carbon offsets that have ever been created. They are either avoidance or reduction projects, meaning they are avoiding future emissions or reducing future emissions. Whereas removal is about removing past emissions. So an avoidance project would be something that says, as a result of this project, there is less carbon going up in the air than would have happened otherwise, which is hard to prove because there's a counterfactual that you have to be able to prove there. And then carbon removal says, because of this project, there is less carbon in the atmosphere than there was previously, and we have sequestered and stored it somewhere relative to a baseline that's been established at the outset. So it's just a kind of fundamentally different thing. And at NORI, we only do carbon removal because it's the situation is, even if you could wave a wand and get rid of all sources of human-based carbon emissions tomorrow, there's still far too much carbon in the air. We have to remove it. So that's why we focus just on removal. So that brings us up to the founding. I'll pause there.
That was an amazing story. Thank you for the full context there. I think it's super fascinating how you found two of your passions, carbon neutrality, climate impact, and crypto technology, and figured out a way to mesh those together in a business, into a working business model. That's pretty incredible. I think this company NORI, the carbon marketplace that you're talking about is super fascinating. I believe it's already up and working, correct? You guys have active clients, have active like trades going on.
At this point that. we're almost 5 years old. So we very quickly started focusing on soil carbon and regenerative agriculture because it is by far the most affordable and scalable method. So what this means is farmers change their farming practices from conventional ag, which means you heavily plow or till your field. You plant your crops in the beginning of the season, you put down your fertilizer, you irrigate, whatever you do. You grow them and then harvest in the fall, and then you plow and you leave the field empty or fallow throughout the winter, and then you repeat the cycle next year. And over time, that's causing a problem called soil erosion, because it's mostly that plowing. What's happening is soil is a mixture of dirt and rocks and minerals, and in it are microbes and fungi and other living organic matter. And when you plant a crop, the crops put down roots, they're sending nutrients to the organic matter are breaking down minerals and providing them back to the plants. It's a very symbiotic kind of thing. When you plow, what you're doing is turning over that topsoil and exposing that organic matter to the air, where a lot of it dies off. And so what farmers are doing in regenerative practices is they're minimally disturbing the soil. So they don't really plow or they reduce the amount of tillage that they're doing. And then they plant cover crops in the winter. So you're harvesting your corn in the fall, and then maybe a week before you do that, you plant rye or alfalfa or legumes or something. So you're keeping roots in the ground year round. The purpose of the cover crops is to feed the organic matter. And the reason that they want to do that is because that organic matter is going to help increase crop yields over time. It's also going to make the land more resistant to both drought, or capable of dealing with both droughts and floods. So over time, they increase their crop yields, their fertilizer usage goes down, and that's a major cost savings, and their fuel costs go down because they end up using smaller equipment for this like direct seed injection too. So this is all beneficial to the farm, but they don't really see those financial benefits for many years, typically seven. And it turns out that paying them for storing carbon in their soil is a perfect form of bridge financing. And the way that the carbon gets stored in the soil is just by increasing the organic matter. The organic matter is the carbon. So when farmers do these practices, they can sequester a little over half of a ton of CO2 per acre per year. That's one half of a metric ton. So we work with farmers who are doing these practices in the U.S., and we first launched the first project with a farmer out of Maryland in late 2019. And since then, it's been well over a dozen farms, about 80,000 tons of CO2 removed, almost $1.5 million paid out to farmers. And you can think about it like everything that we've done to date has been about building the carbon infrastructure for the business. We haven't done the cryptocurrency portion yet. All of these payments for carbon has been in cash at an arbitrary price of $15 that was set by that first farmer. And the price has been like that ever since. But the point of what Nori is trying to do is not be a carbon credit company. We're trying to be a carbon price discovery company, because what we want is for our token, which I'll explain how that works. But what we want is for that to become a carbon reference price. So if you want to know the price of oil today, you go look at references that are just generally agreed upon by the market. So these would be like Brent crude or WTI, West Texas Intermediate. And we don't have that for carbon. There is no such thing. There really is no open exchange where carbon is being traded or anything like that. So that's the intent for the Nori token, which we intend to launch later in this year. And then the way it'll work is one NRT is the carbon asset. So one Nori removal ton. An NRT is one ton of CO2 that's been sequestered for at least 10 years. And the price of one NRT today is $15, but in the future will be one Nori, our Nori token. So that Nori price will float relative to supply and demand. And you can think of the Nori as like a reusable gift card. If you hold a Nori, you haven't bought carbon yet, but you have the ability to redeem it for a ton of CO2 by purchasing an NRT. And then when you get the NRT, it's immediately retired, which is carbon market language, meaning that you're not allowed to resell it. We just fundamentally believe that carbon shouldn't actually be traded, which is very different from the entire rest of the industry, where carbon credits are traded many, many times over and over again. It's really just middlemen pushing pieces of paper around. Very little of that money actually ends up in the hands of the project developers, which we think is just the wrong way to go about it. Because if we're going to be serious about climate change, we should be designing our systems so that every new dollar spent results in net new carbon that's coming out of the atmosphere, not just purchasing a piece of paper representing a ton of CO2 that was already removed a long time ago.
Understood. Can you explain that real quick? So you disagree with the fact that there is currently people are trading carbon, and how does that differ from the Nori marketplace?
Yeah. So historically, carbon offsetting came about as a result of the Kyoto Protocol being adopted in 1997. And what the UN did was created a framework called the Clean Development Mechanism, which was a set of guidelines or rules for how you might set up carbon trading. It was not a carbon market itself. It was just a framework for one. And the idea back then was that developed countries of the world would pay developing countries for their carbon assets. Because why are we developed countries? Well, because we burned a lot of fossil fuels and consumed a lot of energy to get to this point. So who are we to go say to developing countries that you don't get to also do the same thing just because now we know that the carbon emissions are bad? So, but in practice, it ended up being almost entirely private organizations. Like, nation states are not buying and selling carbon credits. That's not how it works. And when these market designers were setting this kind of stuff up, they correctly assumed that they needed some sort of tradable commodity asset, because you need something that investors can buy and sell so that you can establish a price. And when you know what the price of something is, you can start forecasting, you can start planning for the future, you can start planning for, if I invest in a business or build a business myself, how much money can I stand to make off of doing it? Like, you need pricing information in order to make that happen. That's how the entire world economy runs in every single aspect. But that doesn't exist for carbon. And so they wanted that to be the carbon credit itself. But then you get situations where, well, like I was just describing, carbon credits can be traded many times over. And if you look at the total amount of money spent over a carbon credit's lifetime, a very tiny fraction of that actually ends up in the hands of the project developer. The rest of it was just rent-seeking middlemen, brokers, just buying low and selling high. Like, they're not, every time they do that, they're not making any sort of difference on the amount of carbon in the air. They're just trading a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. So at Nori, we don't think that that's an effective way of solving the problem. Like, we're interested in answering the question of how do we accelerate the rate at which carbon is being drawn out of the atmosphere? How do we solve climate change as quickly as possible? Well, the way to do that is to make it as financially profitable as possible for people to pull carbon out of the air. And if we're going to do that, then we should be pushing as much of the money spent by people wanting to buy carbon towards the people who are actually removing the carbon. And so that's what we do. Our revenue model is based off of a transaction fee that the buyer pays. So the price is $15 today, and we charge a 15% transaction fee. So that's $2.25. And all in, it's $17.25 that the buyer pays. 15 of that goes to the farmer, $2.25 goes to Nori. And then that NRT is retired and the buyer owns it forever. We record that on chain, actually as an NFT, and it becomes non-transferable once it goes to the buyer's wallet. And then the idea is, there are a finite number of Nori tokens, 500 million, that are being created. So as the demand for NRTs increases, then the demand for Nori increases, which should then, with a fixed supply, increase the price and incentive for people to enter the market on the supply side.
Yeah. And maybe we're a bit into the podcast right now, but just a basic description of such a marketplace is there are farmers or other organizations that remove carbon from the atmosphere, and they produce carbon removal certificates, right? And these carbon removal certificates can be traded for Nori tokens and other, on the buying side, organizations that are interested in buying carbon removal certificates would use Nori tokens to buy these. And so Nori becomes a marketplace for the carbon removal certificates. Is that correct?
Yeah. And so back when we did the raise with the Republic in 2018, we were calling them carbon removal certificates, CRCs, but we've rebranded or renamed them. So those are NRTs now. So NRTs, Nori removal ton. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So one NRT can be purchased with one Nori.
Gotcha. And you mentioned and
that one-to-one peg is fixed.
Yeah. You mentioned this having a price for something and creating a market for something that helps organizations plan and grow into the future. But I guess the part that I'm confused about is, you know, carbon, you know, NRT, for example, is not a product on its own that people can use. For example, it's not like crude oil where it can be used to create, you know, you can put in your car and you know, use it as a product. So I think I was curious on the buying side. So what makes this buying demand? Is it purely the regulation that governments are implementing that are forcing organizations to purchase, you know, the NRTs, especially with the ESG regulation that is coming out and things like that?
None of it has to do with government mandate or compliance or anything like that. This is entirely voluntary. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the demand that is out there is virtually limitless. It's mostly cultural. So employees, shareholders, consumers are all pushing companies to be more sustainable. And the commitments that have been made by even just a handful of giant tech companies vastly exceed the available inventory of carbon removal that is happening. So this is why I was saying earlier, like, this is a supply side challenge. The demand side is no problem. There's plenty of demand out there. The demand is only going to grow. There's not enough supply happening. So Nori primarily sells to smaller and medium sized businesses who have never bought carbon before. We don't typically sell to the big companies, mostly because the big companies are really stuck in their ways of working with these old legacy gatekeeper offset registries that are they just make it really difficult to transact. It's really expensive. All of their fees are put on the supply side. They have these ridiculous 100-year permanence requirements that are completely non-enforceable. it doesn't work and is not scalable. But the big companies of the world that are buying carbon are they're most concerned about their reputation. Like, they look at buying carbon offsetting as a liability that they're taking on. Because let's say that you were to go buy a bunch of forestry carbon credits, and then a year later you find out, because an investigative reporter shows up and says, hey, did you know that those trees were all cut down, or that they were all, that the forest burned in a fire or something? You're going to get slammed in the press for it. And this has happened a bunch of times. So what they want most of all are assurances that these are high quality projects. I'm using air quotes here. So that just adds up the transaction cost. It makes it really expensive. So only the most well-connected carbon projects can ever get funded in that way. And just none of that is scalable. So that's why we don't work with the offset registries. We had to rebuild this from the ground up to make it much more effective for the future. So we sell mostly to small and medium businesses. And then probably about 25% of our sales these days are coming from Web3 and crypto and NFT type companies. So we partner with Rarible and the Sandbox for NFT stuff. Like anyone who mints an NFT on Rarible can check a box and then go pay for removing a ton of CO2 via Nori. And then we partner with protocols. So Stepin, which is a very popular move to earn game right now, where you can earn tokens by running or walking around. A part of their business model is just being carbon negative. And so they put a percentage of their profits towards buying carbon, and we're their partner for that. So I actually am pretty optimistic that like I said earlier, there's plenty of demand out there. And I'm most interested in that demand coming from crypto type protocols where people are growing new economies and there's a lot of value out there that can be spent on pulling carbon out of the air.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I've seen your announcements with like Sandbox, Rarible, Avalanche. It's really cool to see the crypto ecosystem embracing this climate impact narrative, especially because I think Bitcoin gets a pretty bad rep with the proof of work. I think that's the first thing, one of the first criticisms I hear about Bitcoin, talking to layman people. And
you and me both. It's like always the first question I get asked if I'm talking to a reporter. Yeah.
And I guess, it's an interesting topic because Bitcoin is also not an organization. It's decentralized and you have miners all over the world who are operating it. It's a very interesting topic to dive into since some of the miners actually are using sustainable energy. Like the miners in Sichuan that used to be there before the Bitcoin ban, but
I think a lot of people mistakenly confuse energy usage with carbon emissions, which is not necessarily true. If you were operating off of like 100% renewable or nuclear energy, then you have no carbon emissions from that. And so then if that's the case, then what's the problem? There is a small percentage of environmentalists who just think all energy usage is bad, but they're wrong. So the interesting thing about it is I don't think it's really that big of a deal, frankly. Like we use energy for all sorts of things in our lives and around the world, and it's a trade-off of whether those things are valuable to us or not. If you take the sum of the energy used to run clothes dryers in the United States, that's more than the Bitcoin network. But do we hear like these angry think pieces about how we all need to get rid of our clothes dryers? I mean, maybe.
Mark Andreessen tweeted like, "Dirty clothes are ESG." Replying to this topic.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and then the other thing is like the critics of this are coming at it from most often, I think, a perspective of not really understand, like they're not crypto native. They don't understand the point of this. And so if they look at Bitcoin and see it as, oh, this is just like a speculative instrument that greedy investors are trading, just trying to get rich quick, then obviously to them, that looks like a waste of energy usage. But if they would like open their eyes for just a mere moment and consider that many billions of people around the world live under despotic and authoritarian regimes who are constantly inflating away the value of their currency or are in war situations like in Ukraine right now, like Bitcoin is the most democratized form of money ever created. So if you look at it from that perspective, then like, hell yeah, the energy is worth it. Yeah. So I think it's just a lot of misunderstanding. And then when it comes to Ethereum too, like once the merge happens later this year, then that's a non-issue as well. And if you're deploying on a layer two or an alternative layer one that's using proof of stake, then it's really not that it's really not that much. Like Avalanche, as you mentioned, another layer one, they bought, I think it was like 5,800 tons from us. And that was to cover all carbon emissions for the year. Like 5,800 tons is really not that many in terms of like a network like that. So our tagline at Nori is emit less, remove the rest. So like continually push to decarbonize, move to renewables, move to nuclear, but you can't get to zero on anything really. So just remove the rest, because do your best and then go from there.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And going off of what you mentioned about Bitcoin, besides the energy uses, how it's other impacts, I think that, you know, a lot of criticism has been on the environmental impact, say relating to ESG, right? Because people aren't, you know, when it comes to ESG, you know, it's not just environmental impact that we look at. It's environmental, stands for social and governance. And on the social and governance side, like you mentioned, it makes a huge positive impact that we're not considering, and we're just focusing on the negative aspects. And I think environmental impacts, there's waste and offset it, or move, you know, like Ethereum moving from proof of work to proof of stake consensus mechanism, where it uses less energy is there. I think I'm hopeful for the future, you know, speaking with new climate tech companies like you guys, and also also other initiatives that are going on.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue like, yeah, Bitcoin may be bad for the as far as the E goes, but it's like the best thing ever invented for the S and the G. So I think that kind of outweighs the downside.
So you did mention one thing that I thought was interesting on the buying side of this marketplace, and how that is derived from cultural implication, cultural influences. So I was curious on if you guys were involved in, you know, improving this cultural influence across the globe, or if you've seen any other interesting projects that are tackling this topic to increase this cultural movement around climate change.
Yeah, well, when we started, and I mentioned that hackathon we did in 2017, it was really a month-long like business plan competition. And as part of it, we recorded a podcast. And since then we've produced like 300 plus episodes, I think, of a show called Reversing Climate Change. And so we've had this podcast since 2017, Reversing Climate Change. And it's a place where we talk with people about climate entrepreneurs. What are they working on? People who are working in the climate change space. Like, how is climate change being solved, and how will it be solved in the future? And so that's certainly been a big part of our growth is through that. I would also say that in late 2018, in the fall, when the UN IPCC came out with their, they come out with like a big report every 5 or 6 years. And that was the year that it came out. That was when people first started talking about, hey, we only have until 2030 to start dramatically reducing our emissions. And all of a sudden, which, by the way, is not actually what the report said, all is not lost by 2030. That I definitely do not subscribe to any sort of apocalyptic thinking. Like, climate change is not an existential threat. It will be expensive, and it will harm individuals on the fringes, but it will not... It, like, this is not a threat to the human race. Anyway, tangent over. That culturally really changed. So that's when you saw like Greta Thunberg and like the Extinction Rebellion and Sunrise Movement and these like larger, newer activist organizations being started. And that was when we started to see bigger companies make commitments. So in 2019, in the late summer, was when Stripe announced they were committing like $1 million specifically to carbon removal. And so all that kind of changed really fast. And it's interesting because when we first started the company in 2017, the very first thing that we did was we held a conference in early 2018 called Reversapalooza. And the whole point of it was to say out loud, like plant a stake in the ground and say, hey, we think it's possible to remove a massive amount of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Here's how we want to go about doing it. What do you think? And because at the time, like, no one was talking about it. No one, carbon removal is a very much an assumption now. And there's an enormous amount of money, like venture money, pouring into new startups, like seemingly every week. about this. But back then, we were really the first ones to come out and say that this is a big thing, and it could be a gigantic industry. And so that has dramatically changed. So now I don't have like I would have conversations with investors and try to explain to them how carbon, like where the demand is going to come from for carbon removal. And they were just kind of skeptical of that. And now we don't spend any time talking about that. We spend all the time talking about how do we get more supply? Because that is the real challenge and constraint.
Gotcha. Yeah. Curious to see how that goes. I saw on your website right now, most of the supply is from the farmers, but all farmers, but as you say, there are nascent technologies that are coming out and new sources of supplies that we're going to discover and include in
the process. They're just really small in volume. So like the world's largest direct air capture facility is only removing 4,000 tons a year. That's like one customer for us. So needs to grow.
I guess just for context, how many tons of carbon are produced per year? Do you know this?
Yeah, annually the planet produces about 50 billion tons. yeah, 50 billion a year.
Largest collects 4,000 of the 50 billion.
That's just direct air capture. But yeah, okay. Direct air capture, it's really early days. This is like trying to implement solar power in the 1980s. Like it's expensive. It's not as small, like physically, it takes up a lot of space. It uses a lot of energy and it consumes a lot of water. So it's quite difficult. I've seen estimates ranging, like there's just not enough energy being produced for DAC. Here, actually, let me zoom out back a little bit and just talk about like the climate budget. So as I said, we're producing about 50 billion tons of CO2 every single year. That number has been relatively stable for the last few years, but it's probably going to continue ticking up as more developed countries increase, especially India and China. China's making some moves, but anyway, it's probably going to continue going up for a little bit before hitting some sort of maximum, maybe 60 billion, fingers crossed. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully we start seeing that come back down. So that's going back to what I said our tagline is, emit less, remove the rest. So continue to decarbonize. But we just know that we're going to have to use removal to get to net zero. And then we need to not only get to net zero, we need to go further. We need to pay down our carbon debt, which means we need to remove about 1.5 trillion with a T tons of CO2 from the air. There is a lot that's in the air, and there's also a lot that's stored in the oceans. The oceans have taken up quite a bit of excess CO2, which is why like ocean acidification is a big deal, because this is carbonic acid as it's stored in the ocean. So this is impacting shellfish and other ecosystems, and eventually the waters are going to warm up further, which will kill off the coral reefs and stuff. So that's why removal is important. So looking at the different ways that you can pull carbon out of the air, the nature-based stuff, so soil carbon, tree planting, kelp farming, mangrove restoration, biochar, and so on, back of the envelope, you could estimate at most maybe 20 billion tons a year of removal. This is at like maximum capacity. So the whole, like everyone everywhere is like doing this, which is not going to happen. So 20 billion tons a year max from that. Where does the rest come from? It's going to have to be from industrialized solutions like direct air capture, carbon negative cement, managed mine tailings, other carbon negative construction materials, that sort of thing. So that means 30 billion, 50 billion tons more coming just from that stuff. And like as a planet, we need to be thinking about it like we should be building a metaphorical factory that is planetary scale, that is capable of removing between 50 to 100 billion tons every single year. That is what our objective should be. The UN, those Luddites over there, they talk about trying to get to like 10 billion tons removed by 2050. And I'm like, what? That's all? Like, you need to be looking at 10 billion tons of annual throughput by 2030. So that's going to have to come from industrialized solutions, these artificial manufactured stuff. But that means we have to dramatically increase the amount of energy that we're producing in order to facilitate that. And the only option that is available to us for that is nuclear energy. So we need to probably 5x, maybe even 10x, the planet's global energy production just to facilitate direct air capture. So that's those are other bigger challenges than what NORI is taking on. But that's generally what needs to be done in order to solve climate change. And I think it's doable. And I think climate change is solvable in this century. And by solvable, I mean restoring the atmospheric carbon balance back to what it was prior to the Industrial Revolution, about 300 parts per million. But it's going to take a lot of energy in order for us to get there.
Gotcha. I didn't really think about that factor where it would take energy to remove carbon. And
and if it's going to take energy, of course, you have to do it in a way that's not also producing new carbon emissions, right? So that's why nuclear is really the only feasible solution.
Understood. Oh, this is pretty mind-blowing stuff today. I'm going to need to digest this for the rest of the day, probably. I think this is a super fascinating topic. In terms of, I guess, the listener of this podcast are mostly going to be individuals. I'm sure a lot of founders and of different companies as well. But do you have any suggestions on how individuals can get involved, either with NORI or with climate change? If they feel passionate, if they want to be involved in this process.
Yeah. For NORI, I would say go to nori.com/token. And sign up for our Discord, which has not launched yet as of recording time, but hopefully very soon. So that'll be a place for people to coordinate, talk about, discuss the NORI token launch and how this whole ecosystem is going to work and function. For people who are interested in carbon removal, I would highly suggest going to a website called AirMiners. AirMiners.org is the website. It's a sort of decentralized community of people who are coordinating to learn more about carbon removal, start carbon removal businesses, educate others about carbon removal. That is definitely the best place to go if you're an individual looking to get involved in carbon removal somehow. I would start with the AirMiners community. They're really great and good friends of ours.
Understood. Amazing. And if they want to get educated about this topic, is there like a favorite piece of media, a book, article that you can point them to?
I would say maybe our podcast, Reversing Climate Change, is a good place to start. Some of the back catalog episodes. My favorite episode is episode 31, which I don't remember the exact title, but it was several of us co-founders. One of my co-founders is this woman, Alden Donnelly, who has been in carbon markets for since the beginning, basically. She was at one point the world's largest buyer of carbon offsets, and she's just this brilliant economist. And episode 31 is where we talked about carbon taxes, cap and trade markets, and why cap and trade is like a total scam. It does not actually reduce carbon in the air. When you hear your local politicians talking about wanting to implement cap and trade, you should ask them not to, because it not only does it not do anything for carbon, it actually prevents the growth of a voluntary carbon market. So I think it's net harmful. That episode was all about carbon pricing and stuff. It's really interesting. And then there are lots of other episodes in there. And we also host a different podcast that we call Carbon Removal Newsroom. So that's hosted by Radhika Mulgavkar, who is our head of supply and methodology. And that's a panel show. It's usually a little bit shorter, but it comes out weekly. Looking at like current events, what's going on in carbon removal, who are the movers and shakers, what are the new companies that are coming out, what are the policy approaches that governments are taking, and that kind of thing. And that's a good way to get up to speed on what's going on in the world of carbon removal today.
Gotcha. I will just wrote down the episode number. We'll be checking that out later today.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's, thank you for hopping up. If there's any last words you want to leave to the listeners before you hop off, please give it a shot.
I think it would be to go back to something I was kind of saying earlier, don't despair. Like climate change is it's a big problem and it's worth solving, but it's not the end of the world. And there are lots of solutions coming. I saw recently, I think PitchBook analyzed something like 14% of all venture capital dollars are going into climate tech companies right now. Like the world is mobilizing. Solutions are coming. This is going to be solved. And as someone who's sitting at like the kind of technological frontier of that, like it's very clear to me, but I don't think many other people are really seeing that because this is all very early stage stuff. But like there are a lot of cool startups out there that have all sorts of novel ways of dealing with climate change, and not just with carbon in the air, but like other environmental effects, biodiversity, water preservation, and so on. So just keep your eyes peeled because there's a lot of cool stuff out there. And if it's something that matters to you, like go find one of these companies to work for or found a new company.
Gotcha. Well, thank you so much for the educational podcast today. I'm really excited to have you here, and happy Earth Day to you.
Yeah, happy Earth Day to you too.
Have a good one.